This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction. We start today with a story from the February 1988 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is If Nudity Offends You by Elizabeth Moon. When Luann opened her light bill, she about had a fit. She hadn't had a bill that high since the time the Sims family hooked into her outlet for a week when their daddy lost his job and right before they got kicked out of the trailer park for him being drunk and disorderly and the kids stealing stuff out of trash cans and their old speckled hound dog being loose and making a mess on Mrs. Thackridge's porch. Drunk and disorderly was pretty common, actually, and stealing from trash cans was a problem, only because the Sims kids dumped everything before picking through it and never bothered to put it back. The Sanchez kids had the good sense to pick up what mess they made, and no one cared what they took out of the trash, though some of it was good, like a boombox that Carter Willis stole from down at Haley's and hid in the trash can until Tuesday. Only the Sanchez kids found it first. But when Grace, which is what they called that hound, and a stupid name that is for a coon hound anyway, made that mess on Mrs. Thackridge's front porch and she stepped on it on the way to a meeting of the Extension Homemakers Club and had to go back inside and change her shoes with her friends right there in the car waiting for her, that was it for the Sims family. Anyhow, when Luann saw that $82.67, she just threw it down on the table and said, "Oh, my God," in that tone of voice her grandma never could stand. And then she said a bunch of things, like you'd expect. And then she tried to figure out whom she knew at the power company, because there was no way in the world she'd use that much electricity, and also no way in the world she could pay that bill. She didn't leave the air conditioner on all day, like some people did. And she was careful to turn off lights in the kitchen when she moved to the bedroom and all that. All those things to keep the bill low because she'd just bought herself a car, almost new, a really good buy, and some fancy clothes to wear to the dance hall on weekends now that she was through with Jack forever and looking for someone else. The car payment alone was $175 a month, and then there was the trailer park fee, and the mobile home payments, and the furniture rental, and the light bill was supposed to stay low, like under $30. It occurred to Luann that even though the Simses had left, someone else might have bled her for power. But who? She looked out each window of her trailer, looking for telltale cords. The Loomis family, to her right, seemed as stable and prosperous as any. Pete worked for the county, and Jane cooked in the school cafeteria. No court there. The Blaylocks on the left were a very young couple from out of state. He worked construction. She had a small baby and stayed home. Almost every day, Luann had seen her sitting on the narrow step of their trailer, cuddling a plump, placid infant. Directly behind was an empty slot, and to either side behind, Luann could not tell if that ripple in the rough grass was a cord or not. She'd have to go outside to see for sure. Now, if there's one way to make an enemy at a trailer park, it's to go snooping around like you thought your neighbors were cheating on you somehow. And before Luann got into that kind of mess, she thought she'd try something safer. Back when Jack was living there, she wouldn't have minded a little trouble, being as he was 6'3" and did rock work for Mullins Stone. But on her own, she'd had to learn quieter ways of doing things, like checking up close to her own power outlets to see if she could spot anything funny coming off the plugs. She was still in the heels and city clothes she wore to work, secretary over at the courthouse. She made more money than either of her parents here in Barrenville, which was not exactly the right outfit for crawling around under things. She took off the purple polyester blouse, the black suit skirt, the jacket hung in her closet awaiting winter. the dressy earrings and necklace, the lacy underwear that her mother, even now, even after all these years, thought unsuitable, and into the cutoffs, the striped tank tee and her thongs. Outside, it was still blistering and loud with the throbbing of her air conditioner, which she'd hung in the living room window. She opened the door of her storage shed that Jack had built her, a neat 6x6 space, and took down her water hose from its bracket. The outside hydrant wasn't but 6 feet from her power outlet, and with a new car, new for her anyway, nobody'd wonder about her giving it a wash, especially not on such a hot day. She dragged the hose end around behind her trailer and screwed it onto the faucet, letting her eye drift sideways towards the power outlet. Sure enough, beside her own attachment, another plump black cord ran down the pipe and off into the grass. But where? Luann turned the water on as if a car wash were the only thing on her mind and sprayed water on her tires. They did look grungy. She flipped the cutoff on the sprayer and went to get a brush out of her storage shed. About then, Curtis Blaylock drove in and grinned at her as he got out of his car. "Little hot for that, ain't it?" he asked, eyeing her long, tanned legs. "Well, you know, new car." Luann didn't meet his eye exactly and went back around the end of the trailer without stopping to chat. Becoming a father didn't stop most men from looking at everyone else. She scrubbed at the tires, then sprayed the car itself, working around it so she could look everywhere without seeming to. That ripple in the grass. Now, it seemed to go back at an angle. And then, Lot 17, that was the one. A plain, old-fashioned metal trailer with rounded ends, not more than a 27 or 30 footer. She thought she could see a black cord lifting up out of the grass and into its underside. She finished the car, put her hose and brush back into the storage unit and went back inside. Through the blinds in her bedroom, she could see a little more of Lot 17. A middle-aged pickup with slightly faded blue paint sat beside the trailer. Lot 17's utility hookups were hidden from this angle. Luann watched. A man came out, a big man, moving heavily. Sweat marks darkened his blue shirt. His face looked red and swollen. He climbed into the pickup, yelled something back at the trailer, then slammed the door and backed carefully into the lane between the rows. The trailer door opened briefly, and someone inside threw out a panful of water. Luann wrinkled her nose in disgust. White trash. Typical. Anyone that had steel power would throw water out in the yard like that instead of using the drain. It was probably stopped up anyway. Luann got herself a sandwich and a beer from her spotless refrigerator and settled down on the bed to watch some more. A light came on as the evening darkened. Against a flowered curtain, she could see a vague shape moving now and then. Around 9 or so, the pickup returned. She heard its uneven engine diesel a while before stopping. It was too dark to see the man walk to the door, but she did see the flash of light when the door opened. Her light, she thought angrily. She'd paid for it. She wondered how long they left it on. $82 minus the maybe 27 her bill should be meant they were wasting over $50 a month of her money. Probably kept the lights on half the night. Ran the air conditioner on high, left the refrigerator door open, or made extra ice, stuff like that. She flounced off the bed and into the living room, getting herself another beer on the way. She didn't usually have 2 beers unless she was out with someone, but getting stung for someone else's electricity was bad enough to change her ways. Thing was, she couldn't figure out how to handle it. She sure wasn't going over there in the dark, past 9 at night, to confront that big, heavy man and whoever else was in there. That would be plain stupid. But on the other hand, there was that bill. She couldn't afford to have her credit rating ruined not as hard as she'd worked to get a decent one. She thought of just pulling the plug out, maybe at 2 a.m. or so, whenever their lights went out, and cutting off the plug end. That would sort of let them know they'd been found, but it wasn't the same as starting a fight about it. On the other hand, that didn't get the bill paid. Luann put the can of beer down on a coaster. Even if the tabletop was laminated, there was no sense in getting bad habits. Someday she'd own a real wood dining room table and pretty end tables for her living room, and she didn't intend to have them marked up with rings from beer cans either. She eased back into her darkened bedroom to look between the blinds. The light was still on behind the flowered curtain. It wasn't late enough yet. She went into her bathroom and used the John, then checked her face in the mirror. Her eyebrows needed plucking, and she really ought to do something about her hair. She fluffed it out one way, then another. The district judge's secretary had said she should streak it. Luann tried to imagine how that might look. Some people just looked older, grayer, but Holly Jordan in the tax office looked terrific with hers streaked. Luann took out her tweezers and did her eyebrows, then tried her new plum-colored shadow. That might do for the dance hall on Friday. But thinking of the dance hall on Friday, not ladies' night, so it would cost her to get in, made her think of that electric bill, and she slammed her makeup drawer so hard the contents rattled. She was not going to put up with it. She'd do something right after work tomorrow. She'd make them pay, and she wouldn't cut the cord tonight, because if she did that, she'd have no proof. When they got up and didn't have lights, all they'd have to do would be pull the cord in slowly, and no one could prove it had been there. On that resolve, she went to bed. The blue pickup wasn't there, which she hoped meant the big man wasn't there either. She had chosen her clothes carefully. Not the city clothes she wore to work in case things got rough, but not cutoffs and a tank either. She wanted to look respectable and tough, and like someone who had friends in the county sheriff's office. And so, sweating under the late afternoon sun, she made her way across the rough, sunburnt grass in a denim wraparound skirt, plaid short-sleeve blouse, and what she privately called her little old lady shoes, which she wore to visit family, crepe-soled and sort of loafer-looking. There was an oily patch where the pickup was usually parked. That figured. So, also, the lumps of old dried mud on the trailer steps when it hadn't rained in weeks. Anyone who'd throw water outside like that and steal power wouldn't bother to clean off a step. Luann squared her shoulders and put her foot on the bottom step. That's when she saw the notice printed in thick black letters on what looked like a 3x5 card. "If nudity offends you," it said, "please do not ring the bell." Right beside the grimy-looking doorbell button, just right out there in public, talking about nudity, Luann felt her neck getting even hotter than the afternoon sun should make it. Probably kept the kids away and probably fooled the few door-to-door salesmen, but it wasn't going to fool her. Nobody went around without clothes in a trailer park. Not and lived to tell about it. She put her thumb firmly on the button and pushed hard. She heard it ring, a nasty buzz, and then footsteps coming towards the door. Despite herself, her palms were sweaty. "Just remember," she told herself, "that you don't have 8267, and they owe it to you." Then the door opened. It wasn't so much the nudity that offended her as the smell. It wasn't like she'd never smelled people before. In fact, one of the things that made her so careful was remembering how it was at Aunt Ethel and Uncle Bert's the summer she'd spent with them. She wasn't squeamish about it exactly, but she did like things clean. But this was something else, a sort of heavy smell, which reminded her a little of the specialty gourmet shop in the mall near her sister's Peggy's house in North Dallas, but reminded her a lot more of dirty old horse hooves. Bad, not quite rotten, but not healthy either. And the bare body of the woman staring at her through a tattered screen door had the same look as the smell that wafted out into the hot afternoon. Luann swallowed with determination and tried to fix her eyes on the woman's face, where she thought the face would be anyway, hard as it was to see past the sunlit screen into the half-light where the woman stood. The woman was tall, would be taller than Luann, even if she stood on the ground, and up above her like that, a step higher, she looked really big, almost as big as the man. Luann's eyes slid downward despite herself. She was big, with broad shoulders, gleaming, slightly sweaty, and big. Luann dragged her gaze upward again. She saw a quick gleam of teeth. Yes, the woman knew. Even in that word, Luann knew she wasn't local. Can I help you? The rest of the phrase confirmed it. She sounded foreign, almost, certainly not like anyone from around Barrenville. You're plugged into my outlet, said Luann, gritting her teeth. She had written all this out during her lunch hour and rehearsed it several times. You're stealing electricity from me, and you owe me $60, because that's how much my bill went up. She stopped suddenly, arrested by the woman's quick movement. The screen door pushed outward, and Luann stepped back, involuntarily, back to the gravel of the parking slot. Now, sunlight fell full on the woman, and Luann struggled not to look. The woman's face had creased in an expression of mingled confusion and concern that didn't fool Luann for a minute. Please, she said. She didn't even look to see if anyone outside the trailer was looking at her, which made Luann even surer the whole thing was an act. Stealing? What have you lost? A bad act, too. Luann had seen kids in school do better. Contempt stiffened her courage. Your cord, she said, pointing, is plugged into my outlet. You are using my electricity, and I have to pay for it, and you owe me $60. She'd decided on that because she was sure not to get what she asked for. If she asked for $60, she might get $30, and she could just squeeze the rest if she didn't go out this weekend at all and didn't buy any beer or that red blouse she'd been looking at. You sell electricity? The woman asked, still acting dumb and crazy. Luann glared at her. You thought it was free? Come on, lady, I can call a deputy and file a complaint. Actually, she wouldn't ever do that because she knew what would happen in the trailer park if she did. But maybe this lady who was too crazy or stupid to wear clothes or use a sink drain or take showers wouldn't know that. And in fact, the lady looked worried. I don't have any money, she said. You'll have to wait until my husband comes home. Luann had heard that excuse before, from both sides of a closed door. It was worth about the same as the checks in the mail, but another billow of that disgusting smell convinced her she didn't want to stomp in and make a search for the cash she was sure she'd find hidden under one pillow or another. I want it tonight, she said loudly, and don't go trying to sneak away. She expected some kind of whining argument, but the woman nodded quickly. I tell him as soon as he comes in. Where are you? Luann pointed to her own trailer, wondering if maybe the really woman was foreign, and maybe in that case she ought to warn her about standing there in broad daylight in the open door of her trailer without a stitch on her sleek, rounded, glistening body. But the screen was closing now, and just as Luann regretted not having gotten her foot up onto the door sill, the door clicked shut, and the woman flipped the hook over into the eye. I tell him soon, the woman said again. I'm sorry if we cause trouble. Very sorry. The inner door started to close. You'll be sorry if you don't pay up, said Luann to the closing door. $60. She turned away before it slammed in her face and walked back to her own lot, sure she could feel the woman's eyes on her back. She wasn't too happy with the way it had gone, but thinking about it, realized it could have been worse. Who knows what a crazy naked woman might have done, big as she was. Luann decided to stay in her visiting clothes until the man came home, and safely inside her own kitchen, she fixed herself a salad. She had to admit, she was kind of stunned by the whole thing. It had been a while since she'd seen another woman naked like that, not since she'd gone to work for the county anyway. She saw herself, of course, when she showered and like that, but she didn't spend a lot of time on it. She'd rather look at Jack or whomever. When she looked at herself, she saw the kind of things they talked about in makeovers in the magazines, this too long and that too short and the other things too wide or narrow or the wrong color. It was more fun to have Jack or whoever look at her, because all the men ever seemed to see was what they liked. Cute, they say, touching here and there and tugging this and patting that, and it was, on the whole, more fun than looking at yourself in a mirror and wondering why God gave you hips wide enough for triplets and nothing to nurse them with. Not that that was her problem, Luann reminded herself, but that's how her friend Casey had put it the last time they skinny-dipped together in the river on a dare the last week of high school. But that woman, she could nurse anything, up to an elephant, Luann thought. And besides that, she frowned, trying now to remember what she'd tried so hard not to see. She hadn't been particularly dark, but she hadn't been pale either. A sort of brown egg color all over, with no light areas where even the most daring of Luann's friends had light areas. You could tan nude under a sun lamp or on certain beaches, but you couldn't go naked all the time. But this woman had no markings at all on a belly smooth as a beach ball, and odd for someone who smelled so. She had shaved. Luann shook her head, wondering. Her Aunt Ethel had never shaved, and Luann had come to hate the sight of her skinny legs, hairy and patched brown with age spots, sticking out from under her shabby old print dresses. But this woman, the gleaming smoothness of her skin, almost as if it had been oiled all over, not a single flaw. Luann shivered without knowing why. She stood and cleared the table, washing her single dish quickly. She started to get a beer out and then changed her mind. If that man did come, she didn't want to smell of beer. She looked out her bedroom window. Nothing yet. The sun glared off the gravel of the parking space and the lane behind it. She was about to turn away when she saw the blue pickup coming. It turned into the space beside the trailer, and the big man got out. Today, he wore a tan shirt with dark patches of sweat under the arms and on the back. Luann wrinkled her nose, imagining the smell. He looked sunburnt, his neck and arms as red as his face, all glistening with sweat. He went in. Luann waited. Would the woman tell him at once, or wait, or not tell him at all? She didn't want to go back there, but she would, she told herself. He couldn't do anything to her in daylight, not if she stayed out of reach and Jeannie Blaylock was home if she screamed. She saw the flowered curtain twitched aside, and the man's face in the window, looking towards her trailer. She knew she'd been careful how she set the blinds, but she still had the feeling he knew she was watching. The curtains flipped shut. Then the door opened and he came out, his round red face gleaming. He shot a quick glance towards her lot, then looked down before he went down his steps. He opened the pickup door, leaned in, came back out, shut the door. Then he started towards Luann's trailer. Her heart was hammering in her chest. She had to take two long breaths to quiet herself. He was actually coming, almost right away. She hurried out to the living room and sat poised on the rented tweed sofa. It seemed to take a long time, longer than she thought possible, even trying to count the steps in her mind. Finally, a knock at her door. Luann stood, tried to control her knees, and went to the door. Even a step down, he was as tall as she. A man Jack might have hesitated to fight, but he was smiling her, holding out a grubby envelope. "Sorry," he said. His voice was curiously light for such a big man. "We didn't mean to cause trouble. The money is here." He held it out. Luann made a long arm and took the envelope. He released it at once and stepped back. The connection at our lot didn't work, he went on, looking slightly past her as if he didn't want to see her. His voice, too, had a strange accent, something Luann classified as foreign, though she couldn't have said if it was from the East Coast or somewhere farther away than that. "I have already taken our wire away," he said, glancing quickly at her face and away again. "It will not trouble you again. We are sorry. It was only that the connection did not work, and yours did." The money in the envelope was 20s, more than 3. Luann looked at his gleaming red face and felt a quiver of sympathy. Maybe they hadn't known if they were really foreigners. "You have to pay a deposit," she said, "to the power company before they turn it on. That's why it didn't work." "I'm sorry," he said again. "I didn't know. Is that enough? Are you satisfied?" Greed and soothed outrage and bewilderment argued in her forehead. "It's all right," she found herself saying. "Don't worry." She wondered if she should give some of it back, but after all, they had stolen from her, and it was only fair they should pay for it. Then her leftover conscience hit her, and she said, "It was only 60, anyway, and if for your trouble," he said quickly, backing away. "So sorry. Don't worry. If you are not angry, if you are not reporting this to authorities..." "No," said Luann, still puzzled. "Foreigners afraid of the law? Illegal immigrants? He didn't sound Mexican. Drug dealers?" "No more bother," he said. "Thank you, thank you," and turned and walked quickly away, just as Curtis Blaylock drove in. Curtis looked at the man walking off and at Luann standing there with the envelope in her hand, for all the world like a whore with her pay, and grinned. "Trouble?" he asked in a silky voice. Luann had to stop that right where it was, or she would have more problems than a big light bill. "Foreigners," she said, allowing an edge in her voice. He wanted to know where to find. She peered at the envelope as if to read the address and found herself reading what was written on it. 3217 Fahrenheit, wherever that is. "Not in this town," I told him, and he asked me to look it up on the county records. Somebody must have told him I work for the county. "Pushy bastard," said Curtis. "Why do you think you should look things up for him?" "I don't know," said Luann, wondering why men like Curtis had a knack for asking questions you couldn't answer. "Well, if you have any trouble, honey, just give me a call." Luann didn't answer that, and Curtis went on into his trailer, and she went back into hers. It was real money, all right, all 20s, and there were 5 of them. She could smell a fainter version of the smell in the trailer on Lot 17, but money was money, $100. It was too much and made her worry again. Nobody in their right mind would have paid the 60, let alone more. She made up her mind to send some of it back, somehow. Probably the woman would take it. Women usually did. She readjusted the blinds in her bedroom so that no one could possibly see in, and had a cooling shower, and finally went to bed, wondering only briefly how the foreigners were getting along in their lightless trailer. She overslept and had to run for it in the morning, dashing out of the door, slamming into her car, and riding the speed limit all the way to work. It wasn't until noon, when she paid the bill at the power company with the 20s, tossed the crumpled envelope in the wastebasket by the counter, and put the change in her billfold, that she thought of the foreigners again. Something nagged her about them, something she should have noticed in the morning's rush, but she didn't figure it out until she got home and saw Lot 17, as bare as a swept floor. They were gone. They had left in the night, without waking her or anyone, and now they were gone. All through the subsequent excitement, Luann kept her mouth shut about the $100 and stolen electricity, and made the kind of response everyone expected to rhetorical questions like, "Who do you suppose?" and "Why do you think?" and "Whoever would have guessed?" She figured she was $30 or $40 to the good, and didn't see why she should share any of it with old Mrs. Thackridge, who had plenty already, or she wouldn't own the trailer park. They all knew she'd talked to the man, Curtis being glad to tell everyone, she noticed, but she stuck to her story about him wanting an address she'd never heard of and wanting her to look it up in the county records. And she said she'd thrown the envelope away after not finding any such place and not caring much either. And after a while, they all let her alone about as much as before, which pleased her just fine. But she did wonder from time to time about that foreign lady wandering around the country without any clothes on, brown as an egg all over, and not a hair on her body. And it finally came to her one day as she typed up a list of grand jury indictments when the judge's secretary was off sick, and no navel on the smooth, round, naked belly. She shook her head. Must have been there. Everyone had a navel, unless she had plastic surgery. But why? After a while, she didn't think of it much, except when she was wearing the red blouse. And after a while, she was going with Alvin, who didn't like her in red, so she gave the blouse to the other secretary and forgot about the whole thing. We continue with a story from the January 1988 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is Blues and the Abstract Truth by Barry N. Maltzberg and Jack Dan. This isn't a spiritual or a prescription. It is, however, a precise diagnosis. Bear with me to explain and explain. So this is how it happens. It's 1963, and you are with a girl named Molly. John F. Kennedy was killed 3 weeks ago on the 22nd. You can look that up. And LBJ is telling us that we will continue. Continue with what? Danke Schön and Call Me Irresponsible are playing day and night on the radio, God help us all. You went out to a college bar in Hempstead, Long Island, where they had a guy who played terrific jazz organ, and you picked up this girl who is a freshman at Hofstra and hails from upstate somewhere, maybe Cohoes. She says she was the only Jewish girl in her high school, and this makes every word sound like ow. You've brought her back to your rented room on the second floor of Mr. Seitman's rooming house in East Meadow. You thought you'd have to sneak her into the house, but dictatorial, half-blind Mr. Seitman had gone out to play bingo, and now you're safely behind closed doors and impressing the hell out of Molly with your knowledge of jazz. You're studying music at the same college she's attending. She's a theater major. And you are absolutely certain that one day Your name will be listed in Playboy's annual jazz poll, and you're smart because you're studying musicology. Worst comes to worst, you can teach during the day and play in the clubs all night. You have a 1Y draft status because you have a nervous stomach, and right now you're playing the classic recording of Louis Armstrong's A Monday Date, where he cuts in with a brilliant vocal rendition right after his trumpet solo. Molly has been saying something like she's a virgin and that she believes chastity to be the only valid option for a woman in these times, although she's not opposed to oral sex, not bitterly opposed anyway. In 1963, before and after JFK's extraordinary run of bad luck, it was very chic in college circles to be a virgin, even if you weren't. So this is not surprising or objectionable. Sure, you agree, understandingly. Sure. She looks like she has nice breasts under her skin pink mohair sweater, and you are hopeful of seeing them naked soon. But, and this is the kicker, you are sure the virgin in this crowd. You don't know how to tell her this or cover your inexperience. Luckily, she knows that you want her and senses your awkwardness, and she takes you off the hook easily by making the first move. The important thing is, you are going to come. Coming is definitely not a routine event in your life, with a woman, that is to say. You've been thinking about it all night. Now the black lights are on, and so is the rotating sparkle globe you've installed on the ceiling, and all your posters are glowing like neon, peace signs and astrological signs and all manner of fantastic beasts and nereids are suddenly brought to radioactive life while the room seems to twirl with every possible color. You and Molly are smoking some unbelievably good Panama Red, which a buddy from your band has left with you to stash, and Molly's clothes are off, almost all of them anyway, and you are so stoned out now, the two of you, that you are confusing the music with your thoughts, but you're getting it right, sliding your fingers over her goosebumped skin, pushing and grinding against her, tasting her cigarette-soured mouth, thinking musically of this and that and nothing at all, and that poor bastard JFK, fucked over now by a Texan, and then you are transformed. You are taken up and out, Stony O. You are lifted like the bullets lifted JFK in the Continental. You are yanked, and then you are bearing with me. I am doing what I can to explain. Over and over this goes, but it is vitally important to get it right. There is no understanding without memory. Molly and I can still almost feel your arms trite around me and your tongue, and then you are somewhere else. You are here. You are in this place. It's like being six sheets to the wind and falling down the stairs. It's like being jolted out of a deep sleep. But here you are, young man, no transition. Yank, bang, and you're in a large office separated into cubicles. The push-pin fabric of the five-foot-high cubicle dividers is powder blue. The commercial-grade carpet, a dismal brown. The dividers are on your right, and six people are crammed into the cubicles, one to a spot, phoning until suddenly they all turn to look at you, staring at you, waiting for an explanation. You must have made some kind of squawking noise, and who can blame you, what with Molly's face taking up the field of vision one minute, and now this. You look at these six people and you really want to say, what the fuck is going on here? But that would expose your position immediately. It's not for nothing that you have a little 60s smarts, a residue of late 50s cunning. You still have a buzz on from the grass. Maybe that pot was too good. And you say, keeping your cool, adjusting yourself to the situation, back to work, gang. I just got a shock from the computer. The word just comes to you. Computer. In 1963, that was a tech word like astronaut and new frontier, but you somehow had access to it. Be that as it may, you're still new to all this, and as you look at your hands, you can tell you have aged. You are not 20, that is for sure. Would that you were. The hands are solid and bear the heavy imprints of time. And you know, now you know, that if you raise your hand to your face, you will feel textures, wrinkles, a bristly stiff mustache. Such is the rush of chronology. It is much more than a physical dislocation. Much has shifted. But under the circumstances, you are amazingly calm. You have had all of this latter time to think about that, of course. Your calm, your amalgamation, your synchronicity with the impossible. Because, of course, you are of two parts. There is the strangling, stunned part of you that has come here. And there is the distant and cold part with which you have just merged. It is that distant you that knows about computers and the precise function of this office, which is to sell the unneeded to the unloved under the guise of love and need. You're selling entertainment. This is a cable television sales pit. But the young, dislocated part of you asks, how the fuck you got here, of all places? This is absolutely nowhere. You were supposed to become a goddamn musician. You should be out playing a gig at the Metropole, or maybe the Half Note. At the very least, you should be teaching. Maybe not at Juilliard, but a decent university wouldn't have been out of the question. You certainly shouldn't be managing 6 part-time temporaries working on a Friday night. And your distant older part, the self you are quickly coming to know, the self that has been ground smooth as a stone by 42 years of experience and frustration, doesn't have a word to say to you. Because you know, Stonio, you know. A young woman of about 20 says, yeah, I've had that happen to me too when I'm putting stuff into the computer. Shocks the hell right out of you, doesn't it? She says crudely, smiling. She is swarthy and doe-eyed, and it is obvious that her long shock of white blonde hair is dyed, the ends burned by countless applications of bleach. The part of you with whom you have merged, the worn-out and cynical you who knows computers, understands that her name is Franny. She has been here for 6 months, a long time in the telemarketing game, and not so long ago, you asked her to have lunch with you, and she said, no married men. I've been through that door once, and that was enough. Another humiliation, even though you are the boss, even though you are supposed to be in control. So now, you know of this and other incidents of this man's life. Although everything is new and terrifying, now you know that 20-odd years have passed, and that you have merged with an older self, but whether it is really you or a defeated facsimile, you are not yet sure. There is still a tendril of hope in your heart. After all, this couldn't really have happened to you, but with dislocation comes instant maturity, and you really do know the truth, just as you know that it would be a kind of death to accept it completely. Slow and tentative, fast and desperate, you have the answers, and yet you have none. The buzz from the grass has ebbed, The yanking will do that to you. And you are very cold and very clear on a level of functioning that is so precise that it is the most terrifying thing yet. You are out of control, and yet you are in control. JFK, you understand, has been dead for half as long as he was alive, and Phil Spector is gone. Gone. Come on now, you say cheerlessly enough, as you are in a supervisory position. Let's get back to work, just as if you knew what you were doing here, as if you belonged. But you do. You do. And you go back to the computer. As one part of you gazed in wonder, the other part is monitoring the telemarketing service reps. You also know they're called TSRs. And at the same time, typing names and addresses, answering Y or N to arcane questions coming up on the screen of the monitor, which reminds you of the fluorescent black light posters in your room in East Meadow, the very same room where, moments before, you were kissing and tasting Molly's lips, which were sticky and deliciously red from a recent application of strawberry lipstick gloss. Well, that is how it began, or how it ended. Outside looking in, inside looking out, my mantra. One moment I'm 20 and trying to score. The next moment I'm 42 and supervising cable sales in an upstate district that includes Molly's hometown of Cohoes. I am married to a woman named Ellen Ames. My first and only marriage, her second. We have been married for 18 years and have one daughter, Molly. Though the insane coincidence of a malign but stupid fate, Molly was the name of Ellen's mother. We have careful sex once a week, always in bed and in a missionary position. Ellen is a mathematics teacher at a junior high. I make about $25,000 a year. She makes $30,000. I drive a 1983 Pontiac Catalina and collect bebop and modern jazz, although I don't play any gigs, nor do we have any instruments in the house. I don't need 800 pounds of piano to remind me of my failure. In the years since my merging, return, amalgamation, whatever you wish to call it, I have had 3 adulterous involvements for a total of 8 fornications, none of them particularly successful, all of them with younger co-workers. Ellen knows nothing of this, nor does she know that I was recently yanked out of my past and spilled into my future, all middle having been taken away from me. But I know that if I were to tell this to anyone at all, I would be in severe trouble. Life would tremble. Life would topple. Life would become dangerous and ill-considered. I cannot manage this. I have bills to pay. I have a life, yes, a life to lead. Molly needs a father. She is 11 years old and is beginning to help me in a healthy, bored sort of way. How, I ask you, can I tell anyone of this? How, outside of this recollection, can I make my fate, my condition clear? Only this. Once I was 20, and the shot that killed JFK somehow seemed to have catapulted me into my life. All the years outside looking in. And now I was going to be on the inside myself. And then another shot, another catapult, and I am 40, married, a father, an unsuccessful adulterer, although perhaps I should count it as success that I haven't been caught, a panting, heavy, sad case of a man on the lip of middle age, and I now am on the inside looking out, evicted and entrapped without a single moment, a single moment in the middle. But I do have a facility for amalgamation. I could have just as easily lost it in the first moment of middle age. Instead, I interfaced with the future and saved it. Interfaced. And I pick up a work order for a sale to a new subscriber in Cahos, which precipitates all of this, you understand, and I just stare at it and stare at it. Is that you, Molly? Is that you, I see? First name, middle name, last name? Is that what I have made of you? A name and address on a sales card? I'll never call you. It would be a disaster. I will call you. It will be a disaster. I'll never call you. It would be a disaster. You think of calling her, don't you, Stony Owl? If you do, oh, you poor bastard, if you do, will it take you back? Will it? Will it? Will it? We conclude with a story from the October 1987 issue of the magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is Mountaineers Are Always Free by Avram Davidson. Old Raynall Smith had been mechanic of the number 2 tipple for over 20 years and had seen his eldest son die from catching one on his back when the ceiling fell in Tunnel 6 off the Andy Johnson shaft, and his second son blown up when they let the dynamite set too long at Level 2 Wilson shaft. The third one, time the cage just dropped, Black Tuesday, had a thigh bone drove through his right eye socket, so they say. But you couldn't hardly tell from the way he was holding his youngest son's right shoulder. He says it were a baby one, said old Ray. Young doctor watched hydrogen peroxide bubbling in little Ray's leg and grunted, why in the hell don't you boys keep away from? Well, he don't know rightly where he was, the old man apologized. We hain't buried none back there since I was a boy. Them wooden markers is all fell down, and ain't hardly none of them old free will Baptist people still alive, hardly, and they too old to take care of the place. Place ought to be marked. The boy, noting the rise in the doctor's voice, began to howl right dolefully. His father kneaded the shoulder more intensely as the doctor sloshed hot water and liquid green soap. Well, now, boy, it was only a young'un way you tell. Reckon he'd dent like biting you any more and you like being bet. Why'd he do it, then? Demanded the boy, speaking words for the first time. They'd never believe this back at the university if I were to tell them, which I sure as hell won't. Young Doc tugged at the hard-pulled homemade leather bootlaces, and the boy howled some more. Old Ray was mighty patient. "'Cause it were only a young'un, bar. It weren't scared just as you was.' He stopped, and his face and neck moved convulsively as young doctor reached for the scalpel. "'Oh, sir, can't you save it, please? We air poor folk, but—' The doctor slashed the laces and pulled the boot off the dirty, smeary leg and foot, then dropped the scalpel in the basin and picked up a clean sponge with a hemostat and swabbed at the mingled blood and dirt and cedar-smelling green soap and peroxide. All the while, he went on speaking. Save it. Why, what's up to you? But it doesn't look to me that it'd stand up to another cobbling. Old Raynall's face and hand went slack. His mouth hung. Then he said, you mean the boot? Sure, the boot. What the hell you think I mean? Slosh, scrub, the boy howled. They'd never believe. Look at those teeth marks. Oh, my. What did I think you? I thought you meant the foot, the leg. At mention of foot and leg, the boy screamed and jerked and struggled to rise. His daddy, though it was not very convenient for him to do so, fetched him a good punch the side of head. Blood spurted from little Ray, subsided, nose bleeding. He moaned a bit. Young doctor had been there a year, so he was not terribly shocked, but he was new enough to be angry. What the hell you'd hit him for, Smith? The day was full of bad surprises for old Ray, and still they came on. Half a day's pay as good as lost. Only living boy child bit by a Parson John, if only a baby one. He, the boy's daddy, just now feeling worse than if a daughter had been caught whoring. Boy, a cripple, better dead. And now this? Clean it out real good, give him a tetanus shot against lockjaw. Lucky no reports the Parson John carries rabies. Say, sonny, instead of just crying, why don't you tell me what? Young Doc's eyes did not see that Smith's face had already gone red and mean. He jerked the boy up so that the wet leg slid out of the doctor's hands, then slammed him down again. You don't tell him nothing, boy. You hear me? As for you, why, I reckon the company pays your wages same as mine. I hit him to make him mind, is why. We ain't clean enough for you. You city people think you own the yarth, but you don't own the folks in Cobb Cove here, and you don't own Raynall Smith. He struck his son again. Get that boot on. You hear me? The boot was scarcely on when he left at the double, dragging the boy. Boy didn't utter sound. The young doctor knew that the boy might get poulticed with cobwebs and cow shit and might recover and might not, and that nobody would believe it at the university that the boy had been bitten by a young gal were he to tell it, and that he would not. This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction.